Welcome to Wednesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, learning, culture, and connection through food. Our weekly Prairie Plates discusses community cooking classes, cook and create kits, and a growing collection of family recipes that celebrates local food, culture, heritage, and lifelong learning. Plus, we'll have our regional news podcast. It is Wednesday, and that's Prairie Beat. And we begin Main Street today with a discussion on AI data centers, the promise, the power, and concerns of rural America and concerns of those of us right here in North Dakota. Joining Prairie Pulse host and Prairie Public CEO John Harris is Joe Kennedy from Concordia College, where he's the coordinator of AI initiatives.
Hello, and welcome to Prairie Pulse. You know, joining us today is Joe Kennedy, an academic technologist at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. Joe, thanks for joining us today. You're here today to talk about the rise in data centers across America, particularly in the rural areas, and how they affect what they can have on the communities. But before we get into that, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I am an academic technologist at Concordia. As such, I'm responsible for looking at all of the different technologies we use for teaching and learning. When OpenAI released ChatGPT to the public a couple years ago, that included AI. So now I also have the responsibility of coordinating AI initiatives. So that's become a substantial part of my job, which means that I have to be aware of the broad impact of AI, different ways that we use it, how it impacts teaching and learning, and how it impacts all the career fields our students will go into, which is why coordinator of AI initiatives was chosen as a title. It also means I'm not an expert on AI. Like, I'm not a computer programmer who built the large language models. I'm not an engineer who helped develop the data centers. But I look at how they're built, how they're programmed, how they're set up, and how it works in the way that we use it, both at Concordia College and in the fields we're preparing students for.
Yeah. But what do you really do in that role? I mean, what all is involved with that?
So it ranges from the very granular, where a professor will be looking at a course they teach, say a professor in the health professions, and they want to help prepare their students for the way the students might need to use AI when they're actually working with a patient, working in a laboratory, working in a dentist's office. So they want to redesign their curriculum to include that. To the very macro level, where we say, as an institution of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, we want our graduates to be thinking about issues that might seem esoteric or really broad or they won't deal with in 10 years. So how do we help them think about the impact of AI on privacy rights and environmental issues and intellectual property? So I help the faculty and the staff as they're designing ways to make sure that our students are accounting for all of that.
Yeah, how long have you been involved in technology and what made you interested in it?
I was called to be a math teacher when I was in seventh grade. I taught high school mathematics and programming for 16 years. And then I moved to Concordia College in the role of instructional design because I use technology so often. The role of an instructional designer is to help faculty take what they're already doing that's good and make it even better, more efficient, deeper, broader, et cetera. And I've been doing that for 14 years.
Yeah. Well, Joe, before we get to the main subject, let's define some terms. You know, AI, people, I think, understand, and I shouldn't say that, they know what AI is, artificial intelligence. But then you got generative AI and then predictive AI. Can you define those and tell us the differences? Or?
Sure. So AI scientists have been working on artificial intelligence certainly since the 60s and even a little before. Generative AI is the newest one. And honestly, when you just say AI in conversation, that's what people think you're probably talking about. So other forms of AI rely on like a decision tree, where you ask yourself a bunch of yes-no questions, and then you make decisions based on that. Except that those forms of AI, there might be millions of yes-no questions, but at the end of the day, it's very programmatic. That's not generative AI. Generative AI is called generative AI because when it gives you an answer, it's generating something that it wasn't told it had to say. It didn't follow a series of yes-nos. And it does that by looking at billions of pieces of data and then looking for what they have in common. So, for example, if I ask you who is the first president of the United States, why do you say George Washington?
Because that's what history tells me.
Because you have knowledge. It's something you actually know. Generative AI doesn't know. Generative AI just looks at all that data that it saw, and it realizes that almost every time it sees the phrase first president and United States, right next to it is this name, George Washington. But if we fed it billions of pieces of data that said Abraham Lincoln next to that, it would tell us the first president of the United States was Abraham Lincoln, because it is looking for associations, which words or phrases or pieces of words appear next to other ones and in which contexts. So that's why it's generative.
Okay. So what services does generative AI provide? You know, how does it contribute to outcomes, well, in the medical field or any field?
Well, can I start with like a way you might use it and not even realize it?
Sure.
If you're writing email in either Google or Microsoft, you're typing and all of a sudden you see a phrase appears that's kind of shadowed out. That's generative AI at work. And the way it's doing it is it's saying, I've been watching you type email for years. And a lot of times when you start a sentence this way, this is how you end it. Or it's very similar to this. So I'm going to suggest maybe that's what you want to say. In the medical field, one of the ways that it's used so amazingly well is to serve as a voice transcriptionist. And this frees doctors up where they can take more limited notes because they have an AI that is listening to the voice. And again, the difference is if you did it, you know what the words mean. Generative AI doesn't. It just knows when it sees this particular wave pattern that maybe is the word penicillin, that it probably is exactly the same as this text pattern that spells out the word penicillin. And it's highly trained in the medical field, and doctors never rely on it as that's absolutely what was said. They're always looking to see if anything is off. But it's really, really accurate. And then the doctor has, say, 5 extra minutes with you when they're not taking notes, where they can talk to you, get to know the context, ask more about symptoms. Visually, it can do the same thing. It looks for visual patterns. And so it's very good at helping people take something that they wrote or said aloud and turn it into a picture in an infographic. It's used that way a lot, too.
Well, we invited you here today to talk about AI data centers, a hot topic in the news right now. But before we get into sort of the finer details of it, let's define it. What is an AI data center?
Well, first of all, it's just a data center like we've had for a long time, but for a very specialized purpose. So all those things we just talked about looking for patterns, if you think about when someone asks you a question, you're like, oh, I think I have the answer. And then maybe you've trained your brain to make an association to get you to the answer. That takes some mental energy. You can feel it. An AI has to do the same thing. But computers are far less efficient than the human brain. So for an AI to start looking at all that data and to make the connections so that it can generate something, it has to use an enormous amount of processing power. So thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of computers like the one you may have at home. And they generate heat. And they have to talk to each other very quickly. And the closer they are to each other, the easier it is to talk to each other. Of course, this is a simplification, but that's what's going on. So a data center says, let's take all of these processors, all of these machines, put them in one place, make sure it's really cold so they don't overheat, because every time they make a computation, they're using electricity, generating a little bit of heat. So an AI data center puts them all in one place so that we can deliver electricity to one place, have backup generators, alternate forms of power, multiple ways to cool, because it's far more efficient that way than to have it distributed all over.
Do people use these data centers on a daily basis?
If you use a search engine, you probably do. Not all search engines are AI enabled, but the big ones certainly are. So you can't use Google search engine without using the Google Gemini AI behind it unless you go in and change the settings. If you use Microsoft Word and it's helping you correct your grammar, you're using an AI tool. So somewhere, some data center is processing that request. If you go straight to ChatGPT and ask it a question, or Claude, or Grok, you're going to be using the data center. So a lot of our work on computers involves touching a data center, even if that wasn't our intent.
How do these data centers differ from ones that were built 10 years ago or 15?
They're bigger and they handle more calculations, even if they're not bigger, which means they're generating a lot more heat in order to do that. And again, that's because an AI tool that uses programmatic or algorithmic, the decision tree, the yes-nos, that's an either-or decision. But an AI data center is asking the computer to start making associations where instead of just two choices, there may be hundreds of thousands of choices around the central prompt. And so that's going to require a lot more computing power. Then when you start looking at music generation, audio generation, pictures and video, right? A really good picture requires so much data. Every individual pixel has a different color. What happens when they shift? What's the fading? How is the light hitting the surface and bouncing off? And so now you have to have exponentially more data. So the short answer is they're a lot more complicated. They do a lot more computations. They generate a lot more heat and they need a lot more land.
Are there different types of AI data centers? And if so, what are they?
Some of the AI data centers that are purpose-built. So Microsoft owns a data center, and instead of using water to help cool the environment, it's using refrigerant. So hundreds of miles of piping inside the data center that are just carrying refrigerant around. And that's a different engineering than something that is water cooled or is using what we would think of as super air conditioners.
Yeah. What companies are primarily behind the construction of these data centers? I mean, you mentioned a couple of names. Is it big organizations like Google or Amazon, or are small outfits building them?
I wouldn't say any of them are small, because even the smallest data center, which could be built maybe by a local company, but it is still a massive engineering in terms of the footprint. So it's not necessarily small, but it is sometimes the big firms that we think of, right? Anthropic and OpenAI. I don't know which arm of Elon Musk's companies owns the one in Tennessee, but it powers Grok. But then sometimes you also have firms that are national or transnational who specialize in building and maintaining a data center, and then they lease it to the large AI companies.
Well, according to a Brookings report from November of 2025, the United States has about 5,500 data centers as of June 2025. Is there a reason why the United States has so many of them compared to other countries?
We certainly have a lot per capita, but China definitely has a lot of data centers. Russia is building many data centers. India has data centers. But the reason that right now we seem to have more is because we're one of the few countries that is leading in terms of computing and computing power and different ways of creating AI tools. And so in order to do that, you need to have the data centers to power them. But China is rapidly catching up. China's come up with a couple different ways of thinking about data centers that are very outside of the box. They just opened one that sits offshore, 35 meters under the sea, for instance.
Well, you know, why has there been a boom? I mean, in 30 years ago, we always talked about hardware and software sort of leapfrogging each other. Is it just a technology boom that we've got going on?
Yes, and I feel like improv here. The technology boom is a subset of human knowledge boom. As we learn more, it doesn't progress, right, like a line. It goes like this. So we've got a nice exponential curve. And that's happening with technology as well. And then when OpenAI released ChatGPT, it was the first commercial, quasi-commercial, but certainly the first large-scale way of a new way of thinking about a technology. And so, of course, that immediately spurred a whole lot of other companies saying, well, if OpenAI can think about it this way, why can't our bright people and our smartest minds think about it this way? So that's going to lead to a rapid explosion of development, just like it does with any tech.
Where are the majority of AI data centers located in the United States?
At first, they were wherever they could be built conveniently, so there wasn't one easy way to classify it. Now they're looking, the companies that are building them are looking far more towards rural areas. Land is cheaper, fewer residents to get upset. The problem is, and rural areas with arable land are particularly attractive because if the land is arable, there's a water source close by, and you need a lot of water for most data centers.
How much water is actually used in these data centers, and what's the environmental impact with that?
Well, first, let's be clear that an individual AI query doesn't use that much water. It's less than a teaspoon. It's measured in milliliters. It's just that we make so many of them. But even with that, data centers consume less water than a couple other industries. The biggest one is fast fashion. Blue jeans take thousands of gallons worth of water to make one pair between growing the cotton, the shipping, and the dyeing, which is really intensive. So fast fashion, which designs clothing to be worn for a year and thrown away, actually uses more water as an industry than AI. But AI is growing really, really fast. So the individual use of an AI doesn't use a lot, but collectively, it uses enough water that it can deplete a water table or an aquifer very quickly if it's not managed well.
Yeah. Why do you think some people have responded with skepticism toward data centers being built close to where they live? And why is that?
Well, there's a general, especially in America, there's a general mistrust of government saying we're going to do this big thing. There's a distrust of AI in general. There is no way to build a data center without extreme noise. You know how your computer hums? Imagine 25,000 of them all in one place, and then all the turbines that blow the air and the water pumps to keep it cool and the generators that are always running as backup generators in case something happens to the power grid. So there's the noise. People oppose it because it can take so much land that a local government may feel they need to use eminent domain. We know that it uses a lot of water, so there's a concern sometimes founded on data, sometimes just in our heads, that it's going to deplete the local water. And then there are also many, many studies, including from the Brookings Institution, that talk about the impact on your electricity rates if there is a data center built on the same power grid that you're using.
How much space do they require? An average, I heard, is 100,000 square feet, and with hyperscale ones, up to 100 million square feet.
Yeah, and for most of us, we just think about it in terms of how many football fields is it going to take up. And they're very, very large. They're larger than when Amazon comes in and wants to put a distribution center in town. But again, if you build in a rural area, it may not seem like it's so impactful. And in fact, maybe there's one landowner who has enough land that they'd like to sell, and that can all be done with minimal disruption. But you can't count on that.
Well, overall, what are the long-term versus short-term costs of an AI data center for a rural community?
So the short-term costs are there's going to be disruption, there's going to be construction, you got to put in power lines or build a power plant, lots of wind turbines or solar, however you're going to power it. There's all the lines that are going to get the data in and out. But the long-term cost tends to be that there is no way around it. It's going to use more water than that area is used to. So if the geological surveys are accurate and you've got reasonable predictions of what it will use, it could be that the long-term cost isn't that great in terms of water usage or electricity usage. But if it's rushed into, and this is what the concern is a lot of North Dakota communities right now, is the residents feel that the governments are rushing into agreements and they haven't done all of that research yet.
Another topic when it comes to data centers, especially in rural communities, is about non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs. What role do NDAs play in the construction of data centers?
Well, it's important that I have very little bias, but this is one. I am very biased towards full transparency. So whenever you say NDA, I immediately go, ah! Non-disclosure agreements are needed to protect, like, oh, we have an innovative way of cooling the data center. But a non-disclosure agreement by its very nature means that citizens don't get to know all the information about something that's being built. And if it involves any tax breaks, any public land use, any diversion of water resources or an impact on their electricity, citizens, of course, are going to say, why can't I know what's going on? So an NDA needs to be very carefully constructed to let citizens know what could happen to them without giving away proprietary information for the company owning the data center.
Do AI data centers have positive impacts? If so, what are they?
Well, yeah, there are AI tools in general that have positive impacts when they're well-tailored. Like in the medical community, AlphaFold that has helped envision what every protein we can imagine looks like. Like, these have been tremendous, and they can't happen without data centers. So there are indeed positives. I think when people get a negative view, they're just thinking of the AI slop on their news feed, right? That's a data center powering that, just like there's a data center powering AlphaFold.
You know, is there a way for people to responsibly interact with generative AI despite some of the negative ramifications with the environmental impact?
Yep, and it's the same as every other technology we worry about. If you have a car and you need to walk three blocks, walk instead of driving. If you have access to an AI tool but you need to look up the capital of Liechtenstein, use an encyclopedia or Google it rather than using an AI tool deliberately to do that. That mitigates the use of the tool, reduces demand for the data centers, conserves the resources for the hard questions that only AI can really answer.
We talked before we came on the air about research and things with AI. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The last thing about opposition to AI data centers that the research is starting to reveal in only the past few months is that some people are opposed to AI data centers because they're really opposed to AI. They have a general distrust of this technology. But AI is like out there, right? It's amorphous. You can't touch it. But a data center, you can oppose that building. So someone may be opposed to it for environmental reasons, and then five people are also opposed, maybe for the environment, but really because it's more of a generalized antipathy towards a technology that's not always being well explained and not always being well marketed.
What do you think the future of AI data centers is?
We're gonna see more of them for a variety of business needs, national security needs, geopolitical politics. I believe we're going to see a slowing down of the growth because I believe the AI industry in general is going to become more focused, tailoring itself to the problems it does best, and less just let's throw AI at everyone.
If people are more interested in finding out about this, where can they go? Who can they contact?
For broad overviews, things like the Brookings Institution, other think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, for very specific topics, like if you're worried about the environmental impact, go to something like the Sierra Club. If you're worried about the impact on your local business community, start with the Better Business Bureau, which is going to connect you to national networks of research.
Seems like there's an awful lot to think about on this one, Joe.
Really is mind staggering.
Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Plates and our regional news podcast, Prairie Beat. It's all right after this news.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Ian. Prairie Plates is served weekly. We always have special guests in to talk about food, culture, community. And this week we have Emily Mihalik, our Education Services Associate here at Prairie Public, to talk about some cooking and food initiative she's been working on. She's been having a lot of fun with it, working hard. And you can see a lot of the photos on social media if you want to go to our Facebook page and check that out. Emily, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us a little bit about your role here at Prairie Public.
Yeah, education works with schools, daycares, libraries in our broadcast region. We partner with them on events. We provide professional development, resources. I also make lesson plans for PBS Learning Media that coincide with our production team. So I do have a lot of little things for the parents and educators in our region.
Well, education is a big part of what we do here at Prairie Public and is definitely a priority with John Harris, our president and CEO. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really an important thing to highlight. But Emily, you've been busy organizing cooking classes around Western Minnesota.
Yes.
Discuss some of those fun activities. I wish I would have attended one, but the photos just look like so much fun.
Yeah, they really have been a blast. Our production team this year decided to make some features about local chefs and food. So we thought, why don't we have some events with families centered around some of the same themes? So we have had 3 cooking classes. We just finished our last one. The first one was with Chef Sarah Watson. She is the former owner of Mezzaluna and Blackboard. And she made apple crisp with the families, which was really fun. And got to talk a lot about Minnesota, their state apple being the Honeycrisp. That was at Trollwood. And then the second class was with Candace Stock at the Detroit Mountain Recreational Area. She made kind of a medley of different things featuring items that she actually foraged from outside. So that was a really cool class to sort of teach kids about the things that grow in their own backyard and that grow in the state of Minnesota. And then the last one we did on Saturday was with Andrea Baumgartner. And she brought some food that was kind of part of Birnbaum's menu. We did the egg bake, which I'm sure people are familiar with, and a couple other things from her cookbook, sort of featuring that Icelandic and Jewish perspective. That was in Climax at their community center. And all 3 were sold out and had full attendance and were just really a lot of fun to do.
And for those who don't know about Birnbaum's, it was a really good restaurant, regionally famous, James Beard semifinalist, in downtown Fargo here that closed last fall, and it was a Jewish Icelandic deli. Again, those photos just look really fun, and check out our social media, Prairie Public on Facebook. So what's it been like working with these chefs?
Well, in addition to them just like being really awesome people, they really spent a lot of time thinking thoughtfully about the menu that we were going to have for families. They dedicated a lot of time to purchasing local ingredients. That was kind of the most important thing to us, was showcasing different businesses and organizations and farmers in Minnesota that families can then go to after they attend the classes. So they just did a really awesome job weaving that into the workshops. And they all sort of had their own perspective on food. It sort of worked out so that Sarah's class was a dessert, Candace's was kind of like a main meal, and then Andrea's was brunch. So they all were something different, which was really exciting. And they all think about food in different ways and talk about food in different ways. So it was really great to get their individual perspectives.
I did get to try some of the apple crisp.
Oh, yeah.
So
it was really good.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
So you working in the education department here at Prairie Public, why do you think food and cooking education are important?
Well, with the project specifically, we wanted to do a couple different things. We wanted to show families that they can source ingredients from local farmers, growers, harvesters, seed collectors. There's so many people in Minnesota doing that who are really all around us and in our local community. So that was one thing we really wanted to highlight. But they're also just lifelong skills to have. I mean, I remember I went to a cooking class when I was a kid. It was a French class, and we made these croissants, these ham croissants, and I still make those. sometimes after work. So it's really important to have those skills from a young age. And I was also really excited that adults were attending the classes too, because it really is a lifelong learning thing. You can learn to cook at any age. And it was a great way for families to bond and spend time together.
I was lucky enough to have family members who were good cooks, but that doesn't happen in every family. And I think, you know, highlighting local ingredients, farm to table, nutrition, those are all big food subjects right now. And I think it's just important for people to learn about these things early on. If you're just tuning in here, joining us today for Prairie Plates is Emily Mihalik, Education Services Associate here at Prairie Public. We're having a fun discussion about community cooking classes that she's organized, and now we're going to switch a little bit into these cooking kits called Cook and Create Kits you've been doing. Maybe that was earlier this year or last fall.
Yeah, we were also thinking, how can we maybe make little mini workshops for families to bring into their own kitchens at home with instructions and local ingredients? So we sort of based them on season. Our first kit was Little Italy. And these kits also coincided with films that our production team has made. So we wanted to highlight those as well in the kits. But they're basically backpacks that I distributed at libraries in our broadcast region for families to check out. Little Italy, the first one, was about the families that had immigrated to Dilworth, Minnesota, the Italian immigrants there who worked on the railroads. And that featured homemade spaghetti sauce from Red River Garlic and Produce. And you can catch them at the farmer's market in the summer. They're usually there. And that was really successful. It was kind of, I wasn't sure how people were going to perceive it. Food, you never really know. And I think in the first 2 or 3 days, all of the kits were off the shelves. So that was really exciting. The second group was a Maple Magic kit, and we featured maple syrup made at Maplewood State Park. So families could also learn about that process. And you can actually go to the state park and buy that maple syrup.
I have some.
You do? It's great. And they have their maple syrup days every spring. So we promoted that in the kits as well. And then our last kit, Wild Rice Wonders, it featured wild rice from the White Earth Land Recovery Project and a recipe as well.
That White Earth wild rice is really good. It has kind of a nuttier flavor than your normal wild rice you would buy in a grocery store. And I really enjoy that. And I was really interested in the Little Italy kits. I'm a little bit Italian. And so that's just, and I know some folks in those families over in Dilworth. And it's just really kind of a local fun thing for me with some heritage.
I loved that video, and because I make lesson plans for the videos, it was one that has kind of been in my brain since I started this job, so I was really happy to sort of put it in circulation again and highlight it for people to watch. Yeah.
Well, and we also have some listeners, viewers, folks that have submitted some recipes to our website. There's a webpage in the education section that has a lot of recipes on family recipes, other recipes. Talk about that a little bit. It's a lot of fun. I was going through it. There is a lot of good information on there.
Yeah, I was so happy with the kits, we gave families an option to submit their own recipes to us for our kind of quote unquote community cookbook that's on our education page. And I was so happy with how many families made submissions and how much care and thought they put into them. You could tell that these recipes were often passed down to them from grandparents or aunts or uncles. And I really hold on to my family recipes. That's how I'm connected with people in my family. So it was just really exciting that people were interested in participating. And you can still submit a family recipe to our website if you want to share. I think we are thinking about making a physical cookbook that we can create and distribute to families for free, maybe at events. So it's kind of an ongoing project, and there's no deadline, so anyone could submit a recipe. We'd love to get as many perspectives as possible from all of the cultures in our region.
So to check out those recipes again, go to prairiepublic.org and get into the education section, and there's a portion that's from our kitchens. And I think it's just a really neat initiative we're doing. I'm looking forward to a possible cookbook. I collect some cookbooks from southwestern North Dakota. Particularly, I really like this cookbook from Leffer, North Dakota, that's really getting into it. And it's German-Hungarian heritage from a church in Leffer, North Dakota, and it's a very popular cookbook there.
Oh, yeah, I would like to look at that.
I will show it to you. It's really neat. Well, we need to thank the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for helping to support these food-related initiatives. Emily, it's been great having you in today. I think we should organize a Prairie Plates cooking class.
I would love that. I'm totally on board. I love to cook. So this was selfishly a really fun project for me because I love food so much. I think it's the cornerstone of so much that we do in this region. So I'm totally down.
Emily, thanks for coming in today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun to talk to you.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street, served weekly. I'm Rick Eon. We'll talk to you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Kathleen Risch Charitable Fund, proud to support trusted journalism, education, and the future of public broadcasting.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Well, it came down to a brewery and city market fronted by a group of young entrepreneurs and a longtime civic developer once led by a former governor. Drecker Bruhalla versus the Kilbourne Group. On this week's Prairie Beat, we break down the winning bid and why the Fargo City Commission chose it.
I have to put the hat on of I'm the mayor of the city and what is the best interest of this community. And I've been looking at the Civic Center for 20 years now, trying to figure out what to do with it.
Well, hey there, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back to Prairie Beat.
Our weekly news discussion here at Prairie Public. And Danielle, we've been following this story for a while. It's only right that we close it out with the final word on the topic. The Fargo City Commission has made their choice for where to build its new convention center. And it's going to be right in our own backyard here at Prairie Public, just down the Skyway at the Civic Center in beautiful downtown Fargo.
Yeah, that's correct. It's been a looming discussion, obviously, for many years. The Convention Center Committee worked for about a year and a half trying to figure out where to put this thing, weighing all sorts of questions, whittling down the options, etc. And bringing it down to the wire, you know, the City Commission was supposed to make their choice last month at their previous meeting, but they chose instead to ask one more question. They wanted a side-by-side financial comparison of the final two locations, the Bruhalla site and the Civic Center.
And what I thought was kind of interesting was that the final report by accounting firm Baker Tilly was that they didn't really have a recommendation one way or the other.
Yeah, Commissioner John Strand seemed a bit frustrated with that. The city of Fargo voted in 2024 to approve a 3% lodging tax to help pay for the convention center. But of course, it's not as simple as all that. I thought it was interesting that the Bruhalla proposal included them being responsible for the losses, operating costs, and no additional costs to taxpayers. The commission was ready to make the decision, but, you know, they were really feeling the weight of it as well.
How many times have we seen in our lives where the government does something and then it ends up becoming what we later on call a boondoggle? And I'm not saying these will be, but if something doesn't pencil out financially, if, like as in Commissioner Pepcorn reminds us, this is going to come on the taxpayer's nickel.
Actually, John, the bonding is on a sales tax.
No. If there's a need to go into the general fund because it's not cash flowing,
when
it's
you're talking
on the
about
tax
bonding, it is on the lodging tax.
I'm talking about the cash flow of the entity. And if it doesn't show profit, it's on the public to pay for that deficit, separate from the bonding issue. The bonding issue will be paid back with the 3% revenue from the lodging tax. If the economy goes south, and I'm always wanting to be prepared for the worst, but if the economy doesn't pan out the way we hope it would, it's on us. It's on the city, either project.
Now, the vote was not unanimous. It ended up being 4-1 for the Civic Center. Now, the one holdout was outgoing Commissioner Denise Kolpak, who made a pretty impassioned plea at the last minute in favor of building the convention center next to Bruhalla. And she, too, seemed pretty unsatisfied that the final financial reports didn't really show a clear frontrunner.
Yeah, she made about a 15-minute sort of quick presentation for her reasoning for going to bat for the Brujalla site. She called it a once-in-a-generation opportunity that would change the shape of downtown forever. So it's a big decision. And she used Sioux Falls, an example. Her pitch was for a convention center at Brujalla, and then down the line, a future performing arts center at the Civic Center location.
Future One is a convention center at the Civic Center site. Civic Center site consumed, future options limited. Future Two, convention center at Brujalla, future performing arts center, expanded downtown corridor, two downtown anchors. The question before us is not where to place a building. The question is which future can we create?
And she also mentioned that she understood the process has already been belabored at this point. She said, you know, she believed the Brujalla site offered the greatest opportunity and that a performing arts center at the Civic site would honor the original goal of the Civic Center.
I do have to admit, it's a pretty interesting and exciting idea about a performing arts center in downtown Fargo, although there are already a good handful of options for arts venues around the region. And who's to say that you couldn't just flip those ideas? There's still plenty of room at the Brujalla site. Now, convention center downtown and a performing arts center at Brujalla. That could happen, right?
Yeah, who knows? Commissioner Michelle Turnberg and outgoing Commissioner Dave Pepcorn seem to believe that the most mitigated risk to the public would be to utilize an already existing facility for the convention center. And Mayor Mahoney also pointed out that the Fargo-Moorhead Science Museum is moving forward, but gathering the needed publicly raised capital for that project has been an uphill climb. So he seemed to be of the mind that a performing arts center would also have that same challenge ahead of it.
All right, so the decision was made, four yeses, with Colpack being the sole no vote. It's going forward, so the big question is, what happens next?
It will probably be a minute before they can officially begin. The developer for the project is Kilbourne Group, so the city has to finalize the development agreement with them before demolition can start. That may take 2 to 3 months, but downtown tenants and visitors will probably begin noticing that activity this fall. They plan to use the existing shell of the building, and as of right now, they're looking at it being ready in late 2028 or early 2029. But when it's done, you know, that's when the fun starts, right? Rocky Schneider is executive director of the Downtown Community Partnership, and this week he gave this quote to WDAY News.
I know when I go to conventions, I go out and spend money. I buy something to bring home for my kids, some tourist items, some knickknacks, and then you always go out to eat and drink and shop. And so I think this will be just a great additional, you know, source of revenue for all these small businesses in our downtown.
And you know, while it's going to take a bit of time here before the convention center is ready, it really does feel like a new era of, I don't know, excitement about the future. There's certainly been a lot of thinking about the future, not only as residents were watching this convention center process pan out, but also as they went to the polls this month in choosing their new leadership. Our friend at Forum Communications, Rob Port, wrote about that in his column this week as he pointed out that, at least in his mind, voters in Fargo overwhelmingly chose State Senator Josh Beauchesne as their new mayor. He's young, has a history of public service, underscore that. That was kind of Rob's big point there, and an optimistic outlook about leading the city. He contends that the election wasn't as partisan as it was about experience and, yes, public service. And he said that not only about new leadership chosen for Fargo, but also across the state.
Yeah, elections do have a way of bringing about some sort of changes, and there certainly will not be any shortage of those coming. The new mayor and the new commission will be sworn in at the next meeting in just a couple of weeks here. And so as the convention center goes forward and new leadership takes the helm in Fargo and in other cities across the state, we will be watching that every step of the way.
And got to give a shout out to the guys at Brujalla. You know, I talked to Mark Bjornstad a while back about the bid, and I think everybody was impressed by their energy, their can-do spirit. And, you know, maybe they can have exclusive rights to sell Drecker beer at the new convention center. Maybe that's the olive branch that can be extended and we can all come together around this new facility. It'll be a lot of fun to watch. So, Danielle, what other stories have you and Dave and Todd been getting up to this week in the Prairie Public Newsroom?
We just manufactured our first light bulb on the 12th, June 12th. Today, the line is fully operational, and we're still working through the tweaks, and we're lining everything up. But by the end of next week, we'd be able to make 10,000 light bulbs in one day.
Well, I had a story late last week I thought was kind of fun. On the 4th of July, the only LED light bulb factory in the country is opening in Fargo, North Dakota.
We're seeing a huge push at a national level for industry-led workforce strategies. And so we're really excited about the opportunity for us to align at the state level with that national push for industry to be in the driver's seat when it comes to directing how state workforce systems are ensuring that we have the workers that we need and that those workers have the skills that they need to support economic growth in North Dakota.
The State Commerce Department is accepting applications until next Tuesday for its Regional Workforce Impact Program. And Todd had a really great report on current needs here in North Dakota to address the homelessness issue.
Great work this week, news team, as per usual. Thanks for all of that, Danielle.
You bet. Be sure to listen to Prairie Public for more news or check out our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that's it for us this week here at Prairie Public. Here's a little toast with some pill lager for you. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can hear Prairie Beat every Wednesday on Main Street and anytime you like, wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 24th. The world rejoiced at the end of World War I in 1918. It seemed as if life would return to normal. There was no way to know that the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl were right around the corner. Hard times lay ahead. The bottom dropped out of prices for agricultural products. Wheat was selling for 17 cents less per bushel than it cost to produce. Farmers who had borrowed money to buy more land and new farm equipment during the boom years found themselves unable to repay their loans. What began as an economic downturn eventually became the Great Depression. The combination of drought and depression was driving North Dakota into the ground. Desperate for a change, the state voted for Franklin Roosevelt for president. When Roosevelt took office in 1933, he moved quickly to stabilize the economy and provide jobs and relief. His efforts included innovative and experimental programs such as the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration. Many of these programs directly benefited North Dakota. On this date in 1933, North Dakotans learned that the federal government had thrown another lifeline to the state. North Dakota had been awarded $5,804,448 in federal aid. There were some strings attached. All contracts required a 30-hour work week and a fixed minimum wage. Convict labor was prohibited. Work was to be done primarily with picks and shovels rather than machinery, since that would require hiring more men. Individual projects could not focus on a single area, but had to be widely distributed across the state. A large portion of the funds would be spent repairing old roads and building new ones. Highways would be extended and routed through cities. Safety hazards would be eliminated. The money would also be used for landscaping along roadways. Between 1935 and 1942, Roosevelt's New Deal programs funded the construction of more than 20,000 miles of roads. This included 721 new bridges and extensive improvements to public highways. There were projects beyond roads. One person who grew up in Wishick recalled that many of the facilities were constructed by the WPA. From playgrounds and tennis courts to a swimming pool that remain in use today. North Dakotans continue to benefit from Roosevelt's New Deal. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow, the debate over the proposed 90-mile transmission line between Jamestown and Ellendale. It's our series, A Closer Look with the Monitor. Plus, Tech with Peck, we'll talk about summertime tech, and we'll also hear from Tom Ezern about North Dakota's unofficial poet laureate. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.